From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's edition of Naps Chat. This is the 100th episode of our program. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. This podcast began on October 30th, 2018, approximately 3 weeks after I began at the National Association of Postal Supervisors. I hope you, my listeners, have found our conversations engaging and informative. On this week's edition of Naps Chat, I am delighted to have as my guest an individual I have known for almost my entire time living and working in the nation's capital. That's about 35 years. My friend and colleague, Daniel Blair. Welcome to Naps Chat, Dan.
Thank you, Bob. I'm pleased to be on here today. And I want to say thank you to all your members out there.
I first met Dan when he was Republican counsel to the now extinct House Post Office and Civil Service Committee. He went on to become staff director of the House Subcommittee on the Postal Service, counsel to the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, deputy director, and then acting director of the Office of Personnel Management. He was also the first chairman of the Postal Regulatory Commission. As an aside, he was the last chairman of the Postal Rate Commission. After he left government service, he served as president and chief executive officer of the National Academy of Public Administration, senior counselor at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and since February has served as senior counselor at the Center for Presidential Transition, which is part of the Partnership for Public Service. Once again, welcome to Naps Chat, Dan.
Thank you, Bob. I'm looking forward to this.
Let's get right into it. I'd like to begin with your reaction as the former chairman of the Postal Regulatory Commission and senior congressional staff person whose portfolio included the Postal Service. And the reaction is to the present political circumstances as they may impact the integrity of the Postal Service. As you know, the Postmaster General and the Board of Governors have been under fire for their actions related to postal operations, particularly as those actions may have impacted absentee balloting. For the first time I can recall, federal courts have become involved in the implementation of postal policy. As a former postal regulator and a staff person on Capitol Hill, how do you view the judicial involvement, or I guess if you were the Postal Service, you would consider it judicial interference?
Well, they may consider it judicial activism, but I think that you have to look at these cases in their totality. And if you have now six cases ruling in favor of the plaintiffs against the Postal Service, I think policymakers need to take note and say, what is going on here? Just yesterday, on the 27th, Judge Sullivan in D.C. ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. And I think it's interesting, a quote from him today said that he wants people to vote and he wants them to be able to know that their vote, wherever it is counted. I mean, this is extraordinary for a judge to order a federal agency to report to him daily on changes, on any changes in operations. This is a case of the court getting involved in an agency's day-to-day operations. That's extraordinary. And I'm trying to remember the last time I saw something like that. This is really something where the courts are really stepping in. They are substituting their judgment for that of postal managers, supervisors, and executives. But the election is so important that this really calls for something that draws the public attention to ensure the court cases draw the public's attention. And these are efforts by the judiciary to ensure that we have a full and fair vote.
If you were still chairman of the Postal Regulatory Commission, or you are a commissioner, or even an executive at the Postal Service, how would you view this judicial involvement in decision-making or regulatory decision-making?
Well, I'm sure these are all going to be appealed. They were preliminary injunctions. They haven't gotten to the merits of the cases yet. But as a former commissioner, as a former staffer on the Hill, looking at this, it does raise some concerns that the courts are getting involved in the day-to-day operations. But you have to ask why this extraordinary, you know, why these extraordinary rulings are taking place. Now, these are federal district judges, which means that they will go to their respective appellate courts, and they could be well overturned, so that there's no precedent. But six cases at this point says to me that the Postal Service needs to be very, very careful in how it approaches this. And the question, I think, writ large is, are these precedent setting? And will this signal future judicial scrutiny of not only postal operations, but the elections in the future?
You referenced the decision that was made, or the ruling that was made yesterday, that was October 27th. And that ruling goes into effect today. And we're recording this podcast on Wednesday, October 28th. And there were two things, one of which you mentioned, but there were two items that were part of the ruling. And the first thing, which is rather interesting, is that it directed senior postal managers to communicate directly with postal employees in the form of a stand-up, of stand-ups around the country, that the decisions that were made by the Postal Service back in June and July are officially rescinded. That leads me to believe that the courts do not believe that the decision that was made by the Postmaster General back in August that suspended a lot of those decisions were being communicated to the front line, that he's really directing them now not only to say the words, but actually to deliver the message personally.
Well, it raises the question whether or not the Postal Service complied with those orders. And I would say that this continuing scrutiny, along with ever-increasing judicial review of these operations, says to me that the courts are suspecting the Postal Service has not fully complied with those orders. Hence, additional scrutiny is required and additional reporting requirements on the Postal Service to these courts will be mandated. Again, I haven't seen anything like this. I mean, the courts are not there to operate the Postal Service. And the courts are not there to operate and substitute their judgment on a daily basis for postal management, unless postal management is doing something which, in the court's opinion, may be duplicitous or to the detriment of the country and our ability to vote. Mm-hmm. Again, this says to me that there's something very, very serious going on that would generate this kind of judicial reaction at the Postal Service.
The other item in the ruling is sort of an extension of rulings that came previously, and that is the court is asking for a daily performance evaluation on the part of the Postal Service. That means time, particularly timeliness of first-class mail and timeliness of the processing and delivery of absentee ballots. So we know that they're going to have to provide this data to the courts. The Postal Regulatory Commission, I am certain, is very interested in this data, as well as Congress, and they will probably request the data just like the court is. If you were the Postal Regulatory Commission, what would you do with this data? A, would you request the data? Would you look at it? And if so, what would you do with it?
Well, that's a good question. Is the court going to be in a position to evaluate this? I sincerely believe that voting by mail writ large will be largely successful. I have every faith in postal workers and line managers to be able to do what is right and get this mail processed. But there are some serious questions being raised here at the last minute before the election. Now, I have advised publicly that people vote, if they vote by mail, to get their ballots in early. I understand that I think it's today or it was yesterday that the Postal Service said, if you're going to vote by mail, you should have gotten your ballot in the mail by this time.
Right. And also, I think both campaigns, or at least at least the Biden campaign at this point in time, is saying no longer put your ballot in the mail, either vote in person or deliver it to the official ballot box that might be. So
now,
the mail, that means no longer put your stuff in the mail.
If a voter has been dawdling, I mean, we've had these ballots for what, weeks?
Weeks
now?
Yeah, weeks.
Depends on the state and the jurisdiction, but for weeks. And if you decide to vote by mail on Monday of next week, you're risking the ability of your vote to be counted, especially when you've been told you need to get in earlier and you have the means to get it in earlier. That said, I think the Postal Service is certainly under a great deal of scrutiny, and their daily operations obviously are under a great deal of scrutiny to make sure that they are meeting their previous commitments to process these ballots on a timely basis.
One of the issues that I know the Congress has been concerned about, and the courts seem to have alluded to, is the issue of transparency. And I know you've spoken a lot about the issue and the importance of transparency in an agency's fulfillment of its public mission. And you've spoken about transparency to stakeholders, which includes its employees, like members of the National Association of Postal Supervisors, its postal customers, but equally, if not more important, to Congress. Based on the comments of members of Congress as well as stakeholders, transparency may not have been a priority over the past 5 months. So can you explain how important transparency is to fulfillment of mission and for confidence in an agency?
This is interesting because the Postal Service is often rated as the most trusted agency in the federal government. The Gallup poll has shown that, and that's not just a one-off, but over multiple years. And so the public has faith in the Postal Service to accomplish its mission and do its job. It touches individuals almost on a daily basis. And it's the one federal agency out there that does that. And so you have a high visibility federal agency that is performing a mission that people rely on a daily basis. So if you're going to change operations, and if you're going to implement new policies addressed at reducing costs that may affect service, you need to involve the stakeholders. I know we have a new Postmaster General. He hasn't had experience yet in the public sector, and he comes from the private sector, and the two are very different. Even though we say with the Postal Service, run it like a business, we really don't mean run it like a business. We mean run it like a business until Congress or other stakeholders step in with questions. And so my reaction is that before you move on any kinds of policies or significant policies or procedures like this, you have to communicate it to the stakeholders. You need to tell them what you're doing and why you're doing it. As the Postmaster General, someone may tell a Postmaster General, I'm not being specific about the current one, but they may say to the PMG, you're the boss. Well, he is the boss, but he really isn't the boss because he has multiple bosses out there, including those members of Congress. And members of Congress and other stakeholders need to be briefed and told why significant changes are taking place and the reasons for them and what the expected outcomes will be, and allow them the opportunity to give the Postal Service feedback whether or not these might go in the right direction. And that's, I didn't see that happen with these operational changes that were ordered and implemented in, early and midsummer. And I think that for such a public agency like that, that's a serious misstep. And it raises public concerns about the intentions and about the ability of the Postal Service to deliver on its mission.
And the Inspector General of the United States Postal Service did raise that issue about the lack of communication to Congress and, raise that as a major, major concern. The Postal Service, of course, took umbrage with that allegation, but the IG did, in fact, Inspector General did make that accusation. One of the key takeaways of at least two of the decisions, federal court decisions, and which goes to transparency, is the issue of whether or not the Postal Service should have sought the Postal Regulatory Commission's advisory opinion prior to implementation of those policies. For example, the removal of 700 mail processing machines and suspension of overtime and taking collection boxes out of circulation. Can you explain what the purpose of an advisory opinion is on the part of the Postal Regulatory Commission?
Well, as I recall, the purpose of these advisory decisions is to allow the Postal Service to make public and allow the Commission to review proposed changes that might affect nationwide levels of service. Now, the Commission was always very careful in not getting involved in operations because it was the regulator. And the regulator, should be looking at the larger picture, not the intricacies of daily operations. But sometimes those daily operations impact nationwide levels of service. In this case, it would have been wise for the PMG to go before the commission and explain before the commission in an advisory, in seeking an advisory opinion, what impacts these proposed changes would have, and what the commission's views and what the public's views are. The commission has always been noted for seeking broad comment from a wide variety of organizations and, in fact, individuals. And that kind of public comment can highlight areas where maybe the management didn't think about, maybe highlight areas that show where the public may be most concerned. And I think that in this case, it would have been wise for a new PMG to seek such a advisory opinion. However, these advisory opinions can be very long and can take a long time to work themselves through the commission's system. And in this case, he probably thought, I don't have time to do something like that. But, you know, hindsight's 20/20, and if you look at it, proposed changes of this magnitude really need to have that kind of public scrutiny. Maybe it's not an advisory opinion. Maybe he should, when he was before Congress, he should have explained it in a better way. But, you know, it was after the fact that he went before Congress, not before the fact. And key senators and members of Congress had not been personally briefed on these changes. And if you just look at it, if you go back and look at it, and again, hindsight's 20/20, this is a textbook case of how not to move forward on significant policy changes by the Postal Service.
I do know that the chair of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Carol Maloney, as well as the ranking Democrat on the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, have raised some serious concerns about the implementation, about believe that they were misled, whether or not they were or not, that as yet to be determined. But at least in their perception, they were misled during the process, and including the Speaker of the House and the Minority Leader of the Senate. These are not people you want to make angry, let's put it that way.
Well, especially in this election in which we're facing a pandemic, which has changed the nature of voting across the country, the Postal Service needed to be less tone deaf in stating, and a little bit more insightful in realizing that voters were going to turn to the mail as the avenue to deliver their votes. And it didn't seem to me that they recognized that, or if they did recognize that, they ignored it.
That is a great segue to my next question. And now, you recently authored an article which appeared in the government executive website entitled "The Postal Service Will Deliver on Mail-in Voting." And we've already seen a record number of individuals vote early. I believe as of this point, it is estimated that more than one half of those who voted in the 2016 election have already voted. So let me ask you this. How important do you feel, and I think I know the answer, but how important do you feel that the Postal Service was to the conduct of an efficient and secure 2020 election? And do you think they succeeded?
Well, I don't know. The jury's out on that. I think we'll have to evaluate that after the election. We fully recognize and understand that that first-class mail standards have not been met. But still, that might mean a delay of a day or two or three as opposed to, more significant delays. I've seen figures that, it's in the 80%, lower 90% range, depending on the city and the state. But most of this mail is going to be local, from a local, your local blue box to the local election officials. If it's delayed by a day or two, and if you've mailed early, I think you will be fine. I think the Postal Service can absolutely handle this. But as I said, if you're voting late by mail, like next Monday, I think there is a reasonable belief that your ballot will not arrive on time. And that's why the emphasis, and I can't say that enough, the emphasis is get your ballot in the mail. And it should have been in the mail yesterday. And if it wasn't in the mail yesterday, do it today. But if you're waiting until the end of the week or early next week before the election or the date of the election, you put your ballot at risk. That is well recognized.
Let me just say today is Wednesday, October 28th. That is the today. So if you hear this after the 28th, either your ballot should have been in the mail already, or you're going to have to deliver
Absolutely.
It personally.
And, you know, I don't think that's a burden on voters. I think that given the circumstances that we're facing and given the pronouncements that have been out there, I think everyone knows that the Postal Service has been struggling to meet its performance standards. And so you take that into account accordingly. And so you mail early. I don't think it's rocket science.
Let's talk about the outcome of elections. And the outcome, I mean, the ramifications for the Postal Service. As I said, you served as counsel on the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, which has confirmation hearings, which has jurisdiction over nominees to the Postal Board of Governors, Postal Regulatory Commission, and so forth. You've served in a federal agency. You have now working on transition. You look at agencies, look at inspector generals. Tell me, the outcome of the election, no matter who wins at the end of the day, what impact would this have on, do you believe this will have on the Postal Service?
Well, the Postal Service has been, the last 4 years at least, has been under a lot of scrutiny by the current administration. It's well known that President Trump has issues with one of the Postal Service's largest customer, Amazon, and that the president actually had that review conducted a couple of years ago, looking at what kind of reforms could be enacted to help address the Postal Service's serious financial situation. So elections do have consequences. The president has the ability to shape postal policy by appointing people to the commission and to individuals to the commission and to the Board of Governors. We have three vacancies right now on the Board of Governors. What does that mean for if a President Trump fills those vacancies versus a President Biden? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think if it's a President Biden, he'll be able to choose all three of them, and they can be of the Democratic persuasion, because you will have then a partisan balance on the board, a partisan majority of Democratic appointees. And that's going to influence how the Postal Service operates. It will also influence how the governors evaluate the current Postmaster General. Would the current Postmaster General continue should former Vice President Biden be elected? Would the board see value in retaining him or appointing someone new? I'm not advocating for his removal. I think what's really important now, the Postal Service, is to have some continuity of leadership. But if you change the partisan makeup of the board, along with where you want the direction of postal policy, that's going to be within the governor's hands. And the same with the commission.
Yeah, actually, the next president, if President Trump is reelected or President Biden is elected, could theoretically have four nominees to the Board of Governors, because John Barger, a current member of the Board of Governors, is pending before the Senate as a nominee to the Federal Thrift Savings Board.
Correct.
And if he takes that position, he will vacate his seat on the Board of Governors, which will create four vacancies on the Board of Governors to be nominated.
Well, remember when President Trump came in, I think we had no governor.
That's right. So all the current Board of Governors have been nominated by President Trump.
Exactly. And that's a horrible situation. That's just malpractice, I think, on the part of the Senate not to have moved those nominees during the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, elections, again, have consequences. And you can shape postal policy the president can shape postal policy by making critical appointments to these positions.
One of the more controversial recent executive orders by President Trump was the creation of a new category of federal employees that would be denied many civil service protections and that would make them potentially vulnerable to political retribution. As a former deputy director of the Office of Personnel Management and acting director, What's your reaction to these executive orders, if you have a reaction? And do you think the policy has any impact on postal employees?
Well, first, when I saw this last week, my first question is, why? Why was this done? And does it address a fundamental problem that needed to be addressed? I was concerned to see that there was really no record that allowed us to evaluate how these proposals came about. I know that in the executive order, it cited the federal employee viewpoint surveys and the frustration that many employees have with holding fellow employees accountable. But it seems to me that this broad brush approach to creating a new schedule and removing individuals who currently have protections and who have not been problems to this new schedule where you're basically an at-will employee didn't seem to address the fundamental problem.
And would it have any effect? Do you think it would have any effect on the postal employment, or even though it didn't sort of necessarily directly apply to the Postal Service?
Well, it doesn't apply, but it shows it demonstrates a hostility to any kind of workplace protections enjoyed by employees. And postal employees, through the representation of their collective bargaining units and organizations, enjoy pretty broad protections. And while it cannot contravene statute, it signals a hostility to this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that the postal community should be aware of and continue to monitor should the president be reelected.
Last question. Could you tell us about the Center for Presidential Transition and your role in it? And is, because after the election, there may or may not need to be a transition.
Well, there is a transition. You have a transition from the first term to a second term, and you lose about 45%, 50% of your appointees during a transition, even if a president is reelected. So you're going to have a transition one way or another. But the center is there as a resource for both transition teams and the public to better understand the importance of a presidential transition and what kind of information is necessary to inform policymakers and those who are conducting the transition and appointees on how to make this as smooth as possible to ensure the continuity of our democracy. I serve as a senior counselor to the center, and I've been working on a number of issues affecting the appointments process. I've been real fortunate to be able to work with a really outstanding group of people, extremely talented, and I think that this benefits the public and our democracy by having a resource available that helps transition teams, helps scholars, helps the public, helps nominees, helps agency leaders to better understand what is necessary to take place during a transition and how to ensure that it is smooth and how to get your nominees in place quickly. I mean, especially with the Trump folks, we've seen that nominations take so long, and that's not good for a democracy or a system. I mean, the president has the ability and under the Constitution to appoint these individuals, and getting them in place quickly is a way to be true to the voters' intent. And so the next administration, be it a second term Trump administration or a new Biden administration, will need to move quickly to fill vacancies. And we have a lot of vacancies. And vacancies are not good. Vacancies of critical positions within the executive branch are not good. Accountability is an issue. Who goes up and testify becomes an issue. There are a whole host of problems with these vacancies and how they're filled. And so Center is providing resources to policymakers to help them make better decisions when it comes to addressing these important transition issues.
Well, that seems like a heavy lift, Dan.
It's interesting, Bob, because our transition, 25 years ago, presidential candidates didn't even talk about transition issues. So this effort within the good government communities to say, look, you need to focus on a presidential transition. You need to devote resources to it. Congress devotes resources to it. It funds transition teams from both sides. And you need to start thinking about this early in order to get your folks in place post-inauguration day. We've seen good transitions. We've seen bad transitions. And we're at a critical juncture in our country. We not only are continuing to fight overseas wars, we're facing a pandemic, we're in a recession. This calls for cooperation when it comes to the transition, either or an effective transition to a second term.
Dan, I want to thank you for joining me for this 100th episode of NAPS Chat. We wish the best to you and to the Center for Presidential Transition as it pursues its mission. And I look forward to seeing you in person soon.
Well, thank you, Bob. I just wanted to acknowledge this kind invitation. These views are my own views. They don't represent any organization. But I think that given 35 years in the public realm, I'm passionate about these, mm-hmm. and I will continue to do so. And thank you for allowing me to answer your questions and be a part of the NAPS family.
Thank you so much, Dan. I want to thank NAPS Chat listeners for logging on this week. If you enjoy NAPS Chat, please leave us a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store. And more importantly, share NAPS Chat with your friends and colleagues. By this time next week, we'll know more about the election, but maybe not the outcome. In the meantime, stay safe and healthy.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe.